Please be seated. Right. The court has no further questions. So, Mr. Anderson, I think. No? Looking at the wrong day. No, you might be right. I'm looking at the wrong day. Mr. Winchester.
Morning, Mr. Pelsmaker.
Good morning.
I want to start some questions regarding the basis for PC7 and the alternatives proposed, and then I want to deal with some of the areas of difference between you and Ms. McIntyre for Ngārunanga. Now, the first issue I want to address with you is around problem definition, and you'll be aware from some of the planning evidence that there seems to be degree of denial that there's a problem that PC7 needs to solve. Would you agree with that?
I agree, yes.
But in many respects, the situation in Otago is pretty unique, isn't it? Because you've got significant reliance on deemed permits, a significant number of deemed permits, and some degree of inaction by the council in addressing this issue for the 30-year duration of them. Those are all relevant factors, aren't they?
That is correct, yep.
Yes. And you've got significant overallocation in many catchments. That exists as a matter of fact, doesn't it?
The current plan does not define overallocation. We haven't really established the limits that will be in the new plan, so it's hard to kind of say where and to what extent we're dealing with overallocation. But there is, in my opinion, there's high levels of water use, and there's definitely a risk that we're dealing with overallocation. And yeah.
Thank you. And I believe in your evidence in chief, the Regional Council considers there's a growing demand for consumptive uses, so demand is on the increase as well, isn't it?
It is. We've got a number of growing population centres, and also in the rural area we see an expansion. Yeah.
Thank you. And there seems to be no dispute, certainly from the Regional Council's perspective, that the existing regional planning framework is inadequate to manage the demands on fresh water, and it's not necessarily entirely reflective of the Treaty of Waitangi principles. Is that a position you would agree with?
I agree. The current plan limits the ability to give consideration to values that are relevant to iwi.
Yes. And would you also agree that the regional water plan reflects a prioritisation of use of water and reflects a paradigm of commoditisation? It sees water as a usable resource first and foremost.
One of the problems with the water plan is that it's got a number of objectives when it comes to managing water. And those objectives can be conflicting. For example, we've got an objective that basically states we need to provide for the needs of primary and secondary sectors. And then we've got another objective that says you need to provide for life supporting capacity. When there's a conflict and when you cannot provide for both, the water plan does not give you any guidance. So it's really hard to. It doesn't reflect the priority under the NPSFM.
All right. No, thank you for that. That's helpful. If I can maybe approach it from a different direction. We've got case law now on the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management, the 2017 version, the Southland Regional Plan case law. Are you familiar with that?
I'm not familiar with it. Okay. Not too in any detail. No.
All right. Well, in terms of the concept of a paradigm shift in the way of thinking about fresh water, are you familiar with that terminology?
Yes.
And so what you have, and certainly in the Southland context, was a very clear finding that the NPS 2017 reflected a paradigm shift in mm-hmm. thinking about fresh water. And now we've got the 2020 freshwater NPS, and that is quite explicit around what prioritisation should occur to give effect to Te Manawatu Wai. And so you've got that quite different way of thinking about fresh water, haven't you?
Yeah.
And the fundamental requirement of that is to put the needs of water bodies first, isn't it?
Correct.
Yes. So when you think about that and combine that with the other Otago-specific factors, you would agree then that there is a significant problem in the way freshwater needs to be managed in Otago. Do you?
Correct, yeah.
And the Minister for the Environment has issued a direction that PC7 be considered by the Environment Court and has identified a number of reasons that he has given as to why it's a matter of national importance. Mm-hmm. You'd be familiar with that direction?
I have read them, yes. Yes.
And obviously some planners have not addressed that matter in their evidence, but based on your knowledge and understanding, is there anything in the Minister's direction and reasons that you disagree with? Because you're entitled to give an opinion as to whether there's any gaps or there's anything missing there or inaccurate?
No.
No, you're satisfied with
it.
Thank you. All right. I now want to just move to one of the alternative regimes that has been advanced by some of the planning witnesses and some of the parties, and that is a suggestion that Plan Change 7 is unnecessary and that we should be dealing with NPS implementation through a consent renewal process, and it can all be dealt with through a consenting process. So my understanding is that the bulk of renewals of deemed permits and existing water permits would be dealt with as a restricted discretionary activity under Rule 12.1.4.8?
Correct.
Yes. And are you familiar with that particular restricted discretionary rule?
Yes.
Right. So that's Common Bundle, Your Honour. Common Bundle 1, page 182, 183. And just before we look at that rule, Mr. Pelsmaker, are you familiar with a resource consent decision made by an independent commissioner on behalf of the Regional Council, Last Chance Irrigation Company Limited?
Yes, I am familiar. I've read it, but it's yes. A while ago.
And that related to an application for renewal for water takes from some waterways draining the Old Man Range in the Fruitlands area and which are used to partially used to fill Butchers and Conroy's Dam. Is that your understanding?
Yes.
Yes. And in that decision made by an independent commissioner, there was a very firm finding made that under Rule 12.1.4.8, there was no ability to consider values of interest to Kaitahu or any cultural effects. Is that your understanding of that decision?
That is my recollection.
Yes. So that's an obvious issue if we're going to continue down the 12.1.4.8 route with all of the renewals, isn't it? Because in a way, that excludes consideration of a reasonably material consideration, doesn't it, if Otago Regional Council adopts that position?
Correct, and yeah, especially in light of the NPSFM and the compulsory values and the new NPSFM.
Yeah, and so if we look at Rule 12.1.4.8 and we assume that we're going down a regime of renewal of resource consents, have you thought about the ability to have regard to the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management under all of those matters of discretion? Has that been something you've thought about?
Yes.
And have you reached a view about that as to whether you can shoehorn the NPS into any of these matters?
It refers to a number of mechanisms such as the minimum flow, which arguably could provide for these matters, but the plan itself does not. The primary objective that guides the setting of minimum flows does not provide for consideration of cultural values. So I would say you could argue that there's an indirect link, but it's not a clearly defined link. It would be better if it was more explicit.
Yes, because nowhere amongst those matters does it say that you're entitled to have regard to any relevant national policy statement, does it?
It doesn't.
No. Okay. And so, looking ahead, if we assume we're going down this path, you can imagine there'd be some debate if, for example, my clients wanted to introduce consideration of the NPS and applicants did not. It would, there'd be quite a strong debate about the relevance of those matters, wouldn't there?
It would follow from, I believe, the wording in the RMA, which says have regard to, which is not the same as give effect to. So yeah. there is... Yeah.
And you're familiar with Section 104C of the RMA, which deals with what you can have regard to for restricted discretionary activities. Yes. Thank you. So let's just put that to one side and let's assume that everyone agrees you can have regard to the NPS under this rule. So that's an assumption I want you to build in when you're thinking about this. In terms of a matter to have regard to, that, and I realise you're a policy planner rather than a consents planner, the NPS wouldn't be an overriding consideration, would it? It would simply be one of a number of matters to have regard to.
Correct. It's, there's no obligation. The other thing as well that I think is an issue with that is that the NPSFM sets out a process of outcomes that need to be achieved, but the outcomes themselves still need to be determined through enough framework or through an RPS in which you define what Tamana Otawai means or the long-term vision, so you don't have the actual endpoint, so it's really hard to make a consent decision that actually achieves that.
Yes. And so you wouldn't be, while the requirement is not to give effect to the NPS through a consenting regime, you wouldn't be able to give effect to it anyway because you wouldn't know what the endpoint was. Is that correct? On a
correct.
Case-by-case
you
basis?
Could take some guidance from the policies,
yes.
But I think the endpoint itself is the limits or the outcomes or the target attribute states that you set in your plan.
And so essentially one of the things you might have to do is try and identify tamana otawai and define it for individual applications, wouldn't you?
We're going to sort this, I say with confidence, because court security's gone out the door.
Yes, they don't look like people you want to trifle with.
I don't know whether you want to take a couple of minutes or...
I might box on, Your Honour.
You might box on, but if we need to pause, yes. Just pause. This is too important to be lost. Yeah.
No problem. So you would also need to consider, wouldn't you, the regional water plan framework as another relevant matter?
Correct.
Just pause a second. Rebecca, Mr. Cooper, have you ascertained what's going on out there?
Yes, Your Honour. Security is just checking in with facilities management. I think it's coming from upstairs. Someone's operators and
heavy
machinery.
Okay. All right. Security's gone upstairs to. Oh, security's gone to facilities.
They're just making a call.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Okay. Good. Are you sure you don't want to take
I'm happy to carry on, Your Honour. It might be pretty distracting for the witness, though.
I want a record of this. I think that's what the key issue for us is, actually grabbing it, getting it on the transcript.
Yes.
Yeah. And you're quite right. And in fact, you questioning and the witness responding is...
Well, I can see Mr. De Pelsmaker's trying to block out the noise. think about his answers. Probably isn't trying to block out the questions, but...
No. 2 minutes. Okay.
All right.
We'll give it 2 minutes, eh?
Certainly.
Okay. Whilst we're taking a pause, you've got something to file, you sir? Hand up. Has it been done, or is... Oh, Kathy's got it. Okay.
We could usefully use the time just to talk about the timeframes for the production of the further evidence from the consents team.
Oh, yeah.
If now's convenient.
Yep.
The plan is to call 2 witnesses from within the consents team, the consents team manager who is across the broader work program in terms of how the consents team is preparing to process the applications that are to be lodged.
Mm-hmm.
The second witness will be a consents planner who has been processing consent applications, including applications lodged post the notification of Plan Change 7. So for the real world experience of how though the plan change has been considered and applied to date.
Right, and that real-world experience, how is that relevant in terms of... I mean, I don't want them discussing the applications as such, but...
terms of some of the questions that you had identified when it was suggested that the court might be assisted by this evidence are outside of the scope of expertise of the manager of the consents team.
Oh, OK.
And so having a second resource available in terms of the... how the plan change is being interpreted in terms of some of the matters of control, etc. It was considered that the officer processing might be better placed to answer those questions.
Right.
And what I had in mind was calling the 2 witnesses jointly to field the questions from the court, and it may well...
You mean not producing anything written?
Oh, no, they'll both produce a written brief of evidence, but just in terms of making sure the right person's able to ask the right question,
because there's an overlap. Yes. Yeah, all right.
But we'll get the evidence produced first and then perhaps make a call on that.
Mm-hmm.
As to timing, we were working on having that evidence ready at some point tomorrow and then lodged, and then it'll be a matter of timetabling those witnesses, and I'll need to talk to my friends about other witness availability as to when we can slot them in, but presumably the sooner the better.
About the scene setting, I think that's really important. No, that sounds good. Anyone got any difficulties with that? No. Okay, well, obliged. Thank you, witnesses. Yep. Okay, we're good to go? Oh, good. Okay, we're good to go.
Thank you, Your Honour. Thanks, Mr. Pelsmaker, for your patience. Now, I think my last question was around the need to also consider the regional water plan framework as a relevant matter. And I think we talked about the way that it seems to prioritise consumptive uses, and so you've got that factor to have regard to, you'd agree. And it also favours long consent durations, doesn't it?
It doesn't give much direction in terms of consent duration. It's more like a list of matters, but it creates an expectation for long consent durations. And the practice has shown that that has been the case.
Yes. Thank you. That's helpful. And would it be fair to say that the existing RWP framework doesn't deal very well with the concept of cumulative effects? It tends to deal with things in a very much a case-by-case basis.
It is a difficult matter to grapple, but I agree with you in general, yes.
So when you've got those factors to also take into account, you would agree that for a restricted discretionary activity application, you're going to struggle to achieve the NPS goal of putting the needs of a water body first, aren't you?
Yes.
Yes. And I think you've referred to the procedural directions in the NPS around tangata whenua involvement, and they occur several times in clauses around clause 3.4 and other related clauses,
correct,
don't they?
Correct, yep.
So if we go down this framework, that simply won't occur, will it?
Well, the risk is that you create a framework that will be, sorry, the regime that will be in place will be determined by consents, as you'll have difficulty to bring them in line with the regime that will be in your new land and water plan.
Yes. And that's the exercise that the Regional Council and Mana Whenua have embarked on at the moment, isn't it?
Correct.
And both parties seem to be placing quite a lot of weight on that. Is that a...
Correct, yep.
Yes. So when you then think about the ability to take into account treaty principles, those matters, treaty principles aren't referred to in Rule 4.1.8, are they?
No.
No. And in the absence of going through the procedural requirements of the NPS, which is itself a reflection of treaty principles, then that effectively, that couldn't happen under this regime, could it?
No.
Thank you. I want to now just deal with some differences between you and Ms. McIntyre.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I wonder if the simplest way to do it is to have a look at your latest recommended version of Plan Change 7, so that's the one that incorporates your amendments of 4 March.
Yep.
Do you have that at hand? I wonder if you also just have your evidence in chief at hand, because I just want to... want to keep going on your new restricted discretionary activity rule, and you've had some interaction with the court about some of the detail and purpose of that, but I just want to ask some further questions around that. So in your evidence in chief, and I look in particular at your analysis at page 107, in paragraph 365 and following, and there's quite a detailed analysis there which runs for my maths is not particularly good, but about 6 pages where you analyse the concept of why increasing the extent of an irrigable area is not a good idea. And you've very thoroughly identified in that analysis all of the reasons given in submissions as to why you might make provision for that.
Correct.
And you've rejected all of them.
Correct,
yeah. Yes. And so it was only when you saw the evidence of Ms. Ma that you thought this is a new or different factor that needs to be accounted for. Is that the position? Or did it just make you think again?
It was not just the evidence of Ms. Marr. I believe that there's a number of experts that have said that irrigation expansion, while it creates a risk, does not always create a risk of environmental degradation. So I've taken that into account as well.
Well, my reading of your evidence in chief, and I look in particular at paragraph 371 on page 111, is mm-hmm. that you've gone through that information and the positions of people, including recognising that there is some scientific evidence to that effect, and very firmly rejected the concept of increasing the irrigable area. So yeah. I'm interested as to the basis for the change. And it does seem to be slightly inconsistent with what you've just said.
Yes. So there's 2 key reasons why I wanted to discourage, in my evidence in chief, irrigation expansion. One is for ecological considerations. The other one was for economic implications for landholders. We want to avoid that they're going to invest more and then that investment is going to be redundant. The change in my evidence in reply stems from the fact that, A, I've been able to consider some evidence that points at certain ways of mitigating environmental impacts, and secondly, because in the cases where I've provided for, so where people actually already have made the investment, there's a likelihood that they will apply for a 15-year consent to maximize what they've invested in. The intent of the plan change is actually to provide for 6-year consents, so I'd rather have them applying for a 6-year consent than for a 15-year one.
Okay. But I think you said in answer to a question from Her Honour that you don't know the scale of this particular issue and what your proposed rule is intended to address, do you? You don't know how many people it might apply to?
No. Within the time frame that was available to me, I've not been able to make that assessment.
And in order to be effective at addressing your concerns, you would agree that in terms of the drafting of the rule, it needs to be clear in terms of its application. It can't be open to debate or discretion.
I think clarity is a, is a good thing. Yes. So I agree with you in that respect, yes.
All right. Can we just have a look at some of the drafting aspects?
Yep.
And let's look at... let's look at your new rule. If we look at the conditions for entry, so if we're on page 6 of the document, and the rule's set out there, and it says it's a restricted discretionary activity providing the following conditions are met. But my understanding was, an answer to Commissioner Bunting yesterday evening, that after Roman numeral 2 under A, that should be an or rather than an and. Is that correct?
No, sorry. I might have. It should be, you have to comply with A, 1, 2, and 3.
Oh.
And the or at the end of 3 probably should, from a drafting perspective, it should be either A or B.
I see.
So,
okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, probably not, but that's helpful. And I'm just going to go through the rest of the rule, but that at least explains your intention, so thank you. Now, you had some discussion with Her Honour this morning about the ability to measure the reduction in environmental effects, which is one of the factors that needs to be demonstrated in an application. And last night, I think you suggested that you might take a net benefit approach.
I could have worded that better. I think it's a benefit. Yeah.
Well, let's just think about, for instance, what about a circumstance where the extent of an irrigable area had or raised issues of concern from a cultural perspective? But in all other respects, there were demonstrable reductions in effects of other relevant effects.
You mean ecological effects, or?
Well,
yeah.
Well, I guess that's part of the issue. Mm-hmm. What is the bundle of effects to be considered? And do you see the issue that you may have to place weight on certain effects at the exclusion or expense of other effects? Because by my reading of this rule, if there is a concern about cultural effects and an increase in cultural effects, all it needs is one increase in effect of a relevant type of effect and you don't qualify. Or is that not the intention?
Could you rephrase? Could you repeat that?
Well, let's say you have an assessment before you that says there will be a reduction in effects in terms of discharges, there will be a reduction in nitrogen application, there will be improved water use, because that's a benefit. A concern has been raised by Mana Whenua about a cultural implication, and they are concerned that there's a cultural effect because of potentially increasing an irrigable area. Is that one concern enough to prevent an applicant getting through the gate? Or do you trade one off against the other?
Yeah, that's the issue.
Yep.
I guess with using the word environmental, because it captures everything.
Yep.
So I agree that the rule could benefit from, or the provision could benefit from being more precise in that regard.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And in terms of the need to demonstrate that a financial investment in infrastructure has been made, and that is dealt with in that first factor, infrastructure for irrigation on the additional area to be irrigated was purchased or ordered with a deposit paid. So just thinking about the evidence that would need to be furnished to satisfy that. What if someone's entered into a conditional contract to purchase irrigation infrastructure? Is that enough? Is that a sufficient commitment?
You'd have to link it to the area specifically. Like, you wouldn't accept any... I mean, I'm not a consent officer, but I would expect that to be a relevant consideration, making sure that it's linked to the irrigated area that is proposed to be expanded.
Yes, but I'm talking about the commercial arrangement that's been entered into by the applicant and the supplier of the infrastructure. Doesn't your rule require you to reach judgments about the nature of the arrangement that's been entered into and whether it's a sufficient commitment?
The evidence should include assurances that some financial commitment has been made already.
Right.
Or investment, yeah.
There's no dollar threshold specified, is there?
There is none, no.
And in terms of the type of equipment, it needs to be a judgment exercise as to whether it's relevant to increasing the irrigable area, doesn't there?
When you refer to equipment, do you mean irrigation equipment?
Yes.
It would need to be demonstrated that it's more efficient in use.
Yes, and that it's infrastructure which is directly related to increasing the irrigable area.
Yep.
Yes. So you can see, can't you, that there's some judgment calls and potentially in some quite unfamiliar areas that might need to be made by regional council officers in terms of application of this rule?
Yes and no. Yes, in terms of there need to be some judgment calls made. Mm-hmm. No, in terms of under the RMA, at times you already have to consider investment or financial implications. So my expectation would be that consent holders have done similar assessments already.
Yes, but there's a distinction, isn't there, between matters over which discretion is restricted and specific conditions of entry so
Correct.
That you can rely
yep.
on the rule.
Yep.
Yes. All right. Now, the rule as proposed doesn't make any provision for consideration of cultural matters or effects, does it?
Not explicitly.
No.
The word environment, the way it is defined by the RMA, captures everything.
All right.
But that is, as you pointed out previously, something that could be made more specific.
Yeah. Okay. Well, just in terms of that issue, can we turn over the page to page 8?
Yeah.
And the notification clause that's been drafted. And I think that's the same as the notification clause that appears earlier.
Yep.
Just want to try and understand what it is the intention here is, because it starts off with a very clear direction that there be no limited or public notification. That's the first sentence, isn't it?
Yes.
But then it makes reference to limited notification to affected order holders in terms of section 95F of the RMA. I won't ask you to look at it, but my reading of the Act is that that relates to affected orders under the Marine and Coastal Area Act. Is that your intention? Because that deals
actually
with coastal matters.
Yes, that is my recollection, yeah.
And is that the intention, though, of this?
No.
No?
No.
Okay. So is this an exception to the general rule that there be no limited or public notification? Is that the intention?
Correct.
Yes. And so does seem to be a mistaken reference to marine and coastal area orders, but looking just at the last part of that, we're relevant under section 95B3 of the RMA. That relates to statutory acknowledgement areas. So is your intention that where a statutory acknowledgement area is affected, that limited notification may be given to mana whenua?
Correct.
I see.
I think, if I may add to that, it might be good to be able to consider downstream effects as well on coastal areas.
Okay. Right, thank you. But clearly that drafting and that notification clause might need a bit of a tweak in terms of what the intention is. Yes.
Be open to reconsidering that.
And in terms of the rule that you drafted, the new restricted discretionary activity rule, did you seek the input of the Regional Council Consents Team in terms of interpretation and drafting?
No, I did not have the time to do
all
that.
Right. Thank you. Now, the last question I want to ask you is around the concept of true exceptions. And you'll recall that when Mr. Moore gave his legal submissions on the first day, he had an interchange with Her Honour about the concept of true exceptions being able to be considered under the non-complying activity rule. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Yes. And is your intention with drafting the restricted discretionary activity rule that the circumstances it deals with is a true exception, or is it just a new pathway for consenting?
It's a new pathway for consenting, because it ultimately achieves the same, or it is intended to achieve the same outcome as the controlled activity rule, which is a short-term consent for 6 years.
But gives you the opportunity to decline it because it's restricted discretionary.
Oh,
correct.
Sorry, I thought we were on non-complying. Which rule are we on?
Well, no, I was asking whether the restricted discretionary activity rule was, and the circumstances it dealt with was in the nature of a true exception, or whether it was a whole new, distinct consenting pathway.
Okay,
and the answer is the latter.
The latter, distinct.
Yes.
Yeah, and then following up on the last comment, for how many years?
6 years.
You still think?
Yeah, because
a whole new pathway for a 6-year consent is what you hope to get out of this.
Yes,
yep,
because
okay.
The risk is that people that already have committed to an investment are going to apply for a non under the non-complying activity rule for 15 years. That is, ultimately, we want to keep that a true exception. Those non-complying activity rules should be for the true exception. Therefore, we want to try to capture as many people as possible under either the controlled activity rule or the restricted discretionary rule for 6 years' consents.
Right. No, that's very helpful. Mm-hmm. So if I understand you correctly, the true exception is the granting of a consent for longer than 6 years.
Correct.
And being able to make a case for that.
Correct.
Thank you. It's very helpful. There's other matters I could address, but I understand other council will deal with them. So those are my questions.
Thank you.
And thank you for your answers.
Thank you,
Your Honour.
Ms. Williams.
Mr. De Pelsenmaker, I'm actually going to start with the 2020 National Policy Statement and Te Mana o Te Wai. And just for the record, this is Common Bundle, the start of Volume 3. So the fundamental concept of Te Mana o Te Wai, as expressed in the National Policy Statement, is that it's a concept that refers to the fundamental importance of water and recognises that protecting the health of fresh water protects the health and well-being of the wider environment. It protects the Māori of the Wai, Te Mana o Te Wai, as about restoring and preserving the balance between the water, the wider environment, and the community. And I'm not going to go on to the second clause there. You have certainly referred to the obligations. And again, just to reinforce, there is a hierarchy of obligations in Te Mana o Te Wai that prioritises, first, the health and well-being of water bodies and freshwater ecosystems. And it's particularly the freshwater ecosystems, I guess, which I want to discuss a little bit with you, because we've been talking quite a lot about water bodies, but I don't think we've been talking about ecosystems. So we have heard the evidence of Dr. Alabone that we have in Otago a heap of freshwater fish species, and he's described those in his evidence. And in particular, what we do have in Otago is we have these threatened nidiadromous galaxid fish, and we have a lot of them, and quite a few of them are in places which interact with water abstraction. And you have told us this morning and yesterday that part of the purpose and the intention of Plan Change 7 is to ensure that there is no further degradation of freshwater and of ecosystems.
Correct.
So one of the outcomes of Plan Change 7 must be that we do not inadvertently further degrade those freshwater ecosystems which, amongst other things, are supporting the threatened non-diadromous galaxids.
Correct.
So one of the matters which the Director General raised in his submission is the ability to impose controls to protect those threatened species. And so if we're looking particularly at the controlled activity, we certainly have some matters of discretion in there. This is Rule 10A3 1-1, I think. Yes. So we certainly have some matters of discretion in there over intake method and flow rates to avoid or mitigate fish entrainment. So essentially that's fish screening. We also have at paragraph D, provision of fish passage, and so that picks up on at least two of the factors which are going to be important to our non-diagenous fish species. Mr. Brass suggested in his evidence, and it was also in the Director General's submission, that there be some additional matters of control. And do you have Mr. Brass's evidence there?
I do.
It may be simplest to go to his appendix, which is from page 27 of his evidence. You have it there.
Did you say page 27?
His evidence concludes on page 26, so it starts from there. And apologies, the appendix doesn't appear to have page numbers on it. Oh, it does at the top. So if we flick through to just, I think it's going to be easier to look at where it's consolidated rather than the individual portions. So perhaps if we look at the consolidated version, which starts from page, bottom of page 6, top of page 7 of the appendix. In answer to a question from Her Honour this morning, where she was exploring with you, again, this concept of avoiding further degradation, you told Her Honour that policy 10A21 set out a number of tools to avoid that further degradation, to avoid losing ground. And bottom of page 6, top of page 7 is a consolidated version of changes to policy 10A21. And where I'm focusing on is the new suggested paragraphs G and H. Recognising that we have in the National Policy Statement this focus not just on water bodies but also on freshwater ecosystems, remembering that we are trying to avoid further degradation in the Otago region and that these are a threatened species with a lot of interactions with water abstraction. Do you consider that, perhaps not with the exact wording that's set out in Mr. Brass's evidence, but that it is appropriate to have those as tools which are available to avoid that further degradation?
If this was a long-term planning regime, I would definitely concur with you. I consider, though, that the policy itself gives support to the controlled activity rule. Controlled activity rule, it is anticipated that it's got a limited lifespan until the new plan is introduced. I've considered this, but I also considered evidence of Dr. Alibone, which states that after he looked at Plan Change 7, he did not consider there to be a risk of extinction on those non-migratory galaxids. Also, the controlled activity rule, and I think it's a shared concern amongst quite a few parties involved in this in this procedure, is to make it as accessible as possible. Requiring applicants that would apply under the controlled activity rule to undertake assessments that would inform the measures you're alluding to would make the cost, would add significantly to the cost of those applications, which could cause them to apply for a longer-term consent.
Although they would still have to pass through the non-complying threshold tests, wouldn't they?
Correct.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, why is that?
They would still need to pass through the threshold for a non-complying activity.
Yeah.
I've lost the train. I thought the question was whether you should put these additional measures in the controlled activity rule. Have I got that wrong?
No, that's exactly... Sorry, Your Honour. Yeah. It was just that... The longer-term pathway is only available for non-compliant activity.
Then you'd have to go there.
Yes,
true.
Mm.
Yes.
And that, in part, is because we're trying to avoid that further degradation in terms of the non-complying rule being the longer-term consents.
Yeah. The intent is to get as many applicants... applying for short-term consent. Another consideration is that some of the populations, while I acknowledge that abstraction can have an impact or habitat alteration can have an impact, in some cases, and that's been discussed previously as well, they are there because of a certain flow regime that is in place. So.
And I'm going to come on to flow regime because that's also very important. But just for the moment, dealing with these additional matters of control which are proposed, and I'll move on particularly to Rule 10A311. And that is additional matters K, L and M, which are on page 9 of the appendix to Mr. Brass's evidence.
Yeah.
What you have also told us in your evidence to date is that these are all matters of discretion for consents officers. Is that right?
Under the controlled activity rule,
yes.
They are limited to the ones...
Yes.
Yeah.
And these are... matters of discretion for consents officers, so they're not all of these matters of control will apply in all applications.
That's correct.
And the council, whilst it has told us that it has limited information, it does have some information about where the galaxid species are, and indeed there's a bit of a discussion in both Dr. Dunn's and Dr. Allibone's evidence about the extent of mapping of where the galaxid habitat is.
There is, my understanding from reading the evidence, there is a good level of understanding around the distribution,
mm-hmm.
but there is still quite a bit of knowledge to be gathered around the specific locations.
But there is certainly some information available
there
about
some,
locations.
Yeah.
Yes. Because these are matters which are discretionary, it really becomes a matter for the consents officer to basically look at the existing information the council has and from that make a call whether or not it is appropriate to impose conditions to deal with non-diadromous galaxids in this particular case, doesn't it?
That is correct.
And not having those matters listed in the matters of control means that they cannot be considered.
I guess they can be considered, but they cannot be addressed.
Yes, they can't
directly,
be addressed.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you. I'm going to move on from that. I have already explored with Dr. Allibone the issue of priorities, and I'm going to address that again with you, and that was something that was also you discussed with Commissioner Edmonds yesterday. And what you told Commissioner Edmonds yesterday in your evidence is that the council has records of deemed permits.
Correct.
So it has that information available to it because the deemed permit itself states whether or not they are priority permits or not.
Correct.
You have also proposed, as part of Plan Change 7, that existing cessation of take conditions would carry on to replacement consent?
Correct.
In some respects, the way the priority works is a de facto and in fact a de jure currently cessation condition, isn't it? It's just not one that's imposed or enforced, rather, by the council.
That is an important distinction, I think, because a condition needs to be complied with, mm-hmm. and the council needs to enforce that. Whereas I am not an expert in this area, but I'm not sure if there are any sanctions upon not adhering to a priority if there would be an agreement within consent within deemed permit holders within a catchment, amongst deemed permit holders within a catchment, to deviate from that and have an alternative arrangement.
So I'm not talking about alternative arrangements, I'm talking about legal rights, because these are existing legal rights, and whilst the council may not be enforcing them, certainly the current priority holder can.
They can.
And given that the council has knowledge of them, even if the council's not enforcing them, the council has knowledge of them, where a current priority holder on a deemed permit, that is, that priority is important to them, would you not expect that priority holder to inform the council of that as part of their application for a new replacement permit?
I think that's a question that probably can be better answered by a consents officer.
Yep. If a consents officer is aware that that is something which is important, as I say, they have visibility of what the priority is, even if it's not currently enforced. It could be translated into a take cessation condition, because that's effectively what it is, couldn't it?
It could be translated into a take cessation condition. It could be embodied by another condition shared amongst consent holders within a catchment,
mm-hmm.
and that being a condition on the consent. Yep. There are a number of ways.
So given that, and given that the priorities and the way in which they are exercised means that we have freshwater ecosystems which are habituated to the exercise of priorities, isn't it important to continue those?
As yesterday I already explained that some of the take patterns might not fully, but to a degree, be reflected in the volumes and the limits, the rate of take limits and the volume limits set on the new consent,
mm-hmm.
that will basically prevent people of a lower priority to ramp up their taking so others lose access. I also acknowledge that it's a very, and sorry, it was acknowledged by Mr. Brass as well, that it's a complex matter, not easy to deal with. The intent is, in relation, because we're talking about this in relation to the controlled activity rule, to make the rule as simple as possible. So therefore, it would add another layer of complexity, another layer of cost, that would drive people towards a longer-term consent.
Is it adding another layer of complexity and cost when this is an existing right which is being exercised and which the council are aware of? Where is the additional cost?
Well, first of all, there needs to be an agreement between all the consent holders.
But this is the point, is that it doesn't need to be an agreement because it is in the deemed permit.
But the deemed permit will expire?
Yes.
So my understanding, again, I'm not an expert, the priority system will cease to exist.
Yes.
It is not automatically carried over into the resource consent regime. So therefore, in summary, the RMA does not provide for these priorities to be retained.
It certainly doesn't post October this year.
Yeah.
And that, of course, is precisely my point, is that the priorities exist at the moment. They are being exercised at the moment. We have water bodies and freshwater ecosystems which are used to, this is the way they operate at the moment. We don't want to have further degradation. There's a need to continue the priorities post-October onto these replacement consents.
Isn't the issue that you're addressing, though, the question of what is the risk?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so what is the evidence, or, you know, perhaps a better way of approaching this is to point out in your, you know, in your evidence or in the evidence of any other party, how this risk is articulated, both in terms of the rights, whether they are exercised and how are they exercised. I think I'm just wondering whether you were working on facts or you're working on assumptions. And the assumption is it is a fact there are rights.
Mm.
The assumption is they're exercised.
Mm.
And a further assumption is that they're exercised on a continuing and variable basis, which has resulted in a change in the hydrological flow to which ecosystems have become habituated. And so if all of those assumptions prove true, I understand the problem.
Yes.
The question is, are your assumptions true?
Yes, and I would have to say that's not addressed in the Director General's evidence.
No.
I believe it is addressed to some extent in the evidence for the Otago Water Resource Users Group and potentially some others. Possibly
referring to that evidence then, you know, if that is the case for, you know, those other parties, putting that evidence to the witness would be a better way to go, because I think
yes.
this witness is going, I have no knowledge, or the regional council has no knowledge, and so you're not going to get anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
There's a risk in the environment. What is the likelihood of the risk? That's tested by the strength of the assumptions.
Yes, Your Honour. I would have to say that, unfortunately, I have not at this point read all of the ORUG evidence.
Well, how about you just park it up and come back to it after lunch? How about that? That's actually lunchtime. That's a good place to stop. And we're bang on 12:30, so it's a good place to stop. Have a look at it.
Yep.
But that's, as I see, Yeah, it's not that I don't understand. I understand what the problem is that you're putting, but, you know, is there a risk?
How big is the problem?
Yeah.
Is it a real problem or is this just hypothetical?
Is this hypothetical? Yeah. But I certainly understand what the problem is that you're putting.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, on that basis, we will take lunch and again, you remain in your oath.
All rise.